I'm Laura Murphy-Oates, and this is The Full Story. So there's one question that you're probably thinking about a lot, and that's, when will things return to normal? When will we be able to run up and hug a friend, go to a big concert, or just go outside without thinking about what's safe and what's not? In order to get there, we need one thing: widespread immunity. The idea behind this is that once a vaccine arrives or enough people have had COVID-19, we will be immune from its terrible effects. But new evidence on how our bodies combat the virus is casting doubt on this whole idea that immunity will save us. Today, the search for immunity. It's Tuesday, the 4th of August. Anushka Astana is editor-at-large for The Guardian in London and host of the Today in Focus podcast, where this episode first aired. She spoke to science editor Ian Sample.
From the moment we first heard of COVID, I feel like, understandably, as a society, we became very, very focused on the way out of this. And immediately that centred around the concept of immunity, whether it was gossip about people getting infected twice.
She said, because I never actually developed antibodies the first time around, I may just have gotten reinfected twice.
With this woman not having mounted an antibody response, it is certainly possible that she developed a second infection or became reinfected.
The idea of herd immunity.
Herd immunity within the UK. What sort of percentage of people need to have contracted the virus?
Probably about 60% or so.
What is it that drove that obsession?
I think it's very simple, or the answer I give is very, very simple anyway. And that's just that pandemics are incredibly scary things and immunity means safety. So this idea of immunity has been absolutely at the forefront of the questioning in scientists' minds, and I think everyone's mind actually, since this kicked off. Early on in this crisis, certainly early on as far as the UK is concerned, some really senior figures, the CMO, the Chief Medical Officer for England, and the Deputy CMO come to mind. You know, they were talking about us being in this and then phrase, until we have a vaccine.
And only if we get a vaccine that is really capable of suppressing disease levels will we ever be what we would call kind of out of this.
But that was, quite quickly seen as being incredibly naive, because immunity isn't a binary thing. It's not yes or no. It's way more nuanced than just you're immune or not.
So as science editor, you were already very aware that this wasn't a binary thing, that it was a nuanced thing. And it was in that context that you came across a story earlier this month. Tell me about that.
Well, one of the features of this whole crisis has been that science and the science of COVID-19 has been largely sort of conveyed through what we call preprints. And these are the sort of early versions of manuscripts of scientific reports that researchers, churn out. And let's face it, this pandemic has basically meant every scientist on the planet who can is now working on COVID. So there are phenomenal numbers of these preprints being produced. There are hundreds of papers a day.
Do you have to read hundreds?
I skim them. I mean, I look at the titles, and then if something looks interesting, I'll get the full paper and read through it. But an awful lot of it is rubbish. An awful, awful lot of it is bad. But I was working on a Sunday and I was in the office, luckily. Let's face it, probably only two or three other people were. And it's a ghost town. And I was scrolling through all the papers on this preprint server just to see what had gone up overnight. And I say these headlines, the titles that scientists give papers can be pretty dry. And the title, I saw this one paper and it was called Longitudinal Evaluation and Decline of Antibody Responses in SARS-CoV-2 Infection. So this was obviously addressing this massive question of what sort of antibodies do we get against coronavirus? And the antibodies are what is going to protect us against it, by and large. And how long do they last? They had looked at antibody levels in people after getting coronavirus. But not only, people had done that bit before, but what was nice about this report is they had multiple measurements in the same people. So you could see how one person's immune response varied over time after they recovered from the infection. And what that showed was, you know, when you get infected, yes, you get a whole load of antibodies raised against that virus. But then what was really interesting was after a few months, they wane, and they wane quite dramatically. And they were showing that in some of the people, their antibodies had returned to normal within 3 months. So their interpretation of that was, well, you know, this looks more like our immune system's response to a common cold. And a common cold, you know, you can pick up the same one a year after you've had it because your immunity doesn't last that long. So I thought that was interesting.
COVID-19 patients who generated antibodies for the virus could still be vulnerable to reinfection, according to research by King's College London.
UK suggesting immunity to COVID-19 could be lost in just a matter of months. We've heard anecdotal evidence of people.
I think we'd all been told you may only get a few years of immunity, but it was assumed you would have some. This is really quite different than what people had been hearing. You know, Professor, one clinic in New York City in a neighborhood that was particularly hard hit by the virus had 68% of its antibody tests come back positive.
Now, within as early as 2 to 3 months, this obviously has implications clinically, societally, behaviorally for reinfection, for the utility and durability of a vaccine, and also for the ability for someone to be reinfected. So people think...
You thought it was interesting.
Okay, it was utterly devastating.
Tell us why it was utterly devastating. What did this kind of break apart in terms of people's assumptions about COVID-19?
It's pretty gutting to hear because it means, you know, once you've become infected, it doesn't mean you won't get infected again. And it also raises some questions about how effective will vaccines be? Because if you're relying only on the antibodies to protect you and the antibodies that a vaccine produces are short-lived as well, then we're talking about, you know, you start having to ask questions about, are we going to have to vaccinate people every 6 months or every year? Are we going to have to give multiple shots of the vaccine every 6 months? And these are questions which have huge implications for the actual vaccine program we're going to need to properly get on top of this virus.
I mean, you're describing it in a very calm and scientific way, but you did mention the word
I'm a calm and scientific person,
Anushka. that's what we need right now. But honestly, Ian, when I read your story, I'll tell you that I felt like crying. It felt like that really gutting moment when you basically pop the balloon of hope that we had around this issue of immunity. And I remember actually watching you over video conference talk to Guardian colleagues about it, and I felt like I could feel the collective despair in all our colleagues' bedrooms collapsing in an instant. Did you get a strong reaction?
I mean, it's heartening to hear that I had that effect on my colleagues.
Sorry.
I think it's one of the benefits of everybody working from home, although I was in the office that day, that they don't wander over to your desk and thank you for ruining their day.
Text you.
Yeah, I got some messages of thanks for that. And I remember one scientist who got in touch was saying, look, this really, first of all, puts the nail in the coffin of the idea of herd immunity, but also that apparently there's a thing that COVID-19 parties are a thing where people go along and, you know, intentionally try and get infected so that they are then protected.
What, like chickenpox parties?
Yeah. And the same scientist was saying this should really make anyone who would be crazy enough to think about doing that should really make them think twice, because you're gambling if you get this infection. And then assuming that that's it for you, that you're then protective the rest of your life or for a decent amount of time, you know, it's just plain wrong.
Plain wrong, but did it mean that we're all doomed? Did it mean that getting COVID means nothing for your immunity?
It's not good news. The immune system's more complicated than that. It's not all just about antibodies.
Okay, give me some hope. How else can we get immunity if we aren't retaining these antibodies?
The good news, I guess, is that antibodies are only part of the story. And you can think of the immune system, I've seen it described this way, as an orchestra. And so your antibodies will be one prominent instrument. You also have a whole stack of other cells that are doing things to help fight off infections. And a really key part that goes alongside, goes hand in hand with your antibody response, is what's called your T cell response. And T cells do a different job to antibodies. Antibodies take a while to recognize the virus, and they flood the system, and they actually they're physically designed to latch onto the virus and take it out. What T cells do is they go after infected cells. So obviously, when the virus comes in, it gets inside a cell, it then hijacks your cellular machinery to churn out way more virus, and then they burst out the cells and it spreads and spreads. T cells go after the cells while they're infected to stop that happening. It's a really important part of the immune response, really important part of your ability to fight an infection. Now, typically with a viral infection, you'll have a T cell response and an antibody response. There's one idea that's being looked at right now, which is that there's a possibility that some people who don't produce really any detectable antibodies when they get COVID-19, and these people do exist, they may just be fighting off with T cells. They may not need to launch this massive antibody response. Something that sort of feeds into this is that the immune system also has this ability to kind of remember previous infections. And this involves T cells and things called memory B cells, and again, a host of other supporting characters. And it's kind of like the next best thing to having antibodies all ready to go. What these are is they enable the immune system to remember an infection. So if it does come along again, if there's a second wave or what have you, if you're exposed again, your immune system recognizes it very quickly and can get the army rolling fast. So instead of your antibodies taking weeks to generate, they're generated in big numbers in days. And so you have your T cell response, which is already there. You have your antibodies, which have been churned into your system really rapidly to fight the virus on the second time around. And that should mean that you're, you know, if you're infected again, the hope is at least that you fight it off way better than you did the first time around. Now, this is all unknown. I mean, this is the hope, but it's what's actively being researched right now.
Next, what does all of this mean in the hunt for a vaccine?
All of what you're saying is significant when it comes to the issue of vaccination, because vaccines that are out there are often not just about encouraging our immune system to create antibodies, but T cells as well. Last week, we had this huge news story. Oxford University announced the latest results from its vaccine trial.
A team of scientists at Oxford University say they've reached a really important milestone in their work to develop a vaccine for coronavirus. They say the vaccine they're developing appears to be safe and triggers an immune response based on early trials involving more than...
What did that tell us?
The latest load of data that came out on the Oxford vaccine was showing that people who have been given that shot of vaccine, they had a good T cell response within a fortnight and an antibody response in about a month. So it's really encouraging that they've seen both a T cell response and an antibody response, because if they hadn't, then it really would have been back to the drawing board. But all it means is that we can say so far, so good. It doesn't mean we can say this will be 60% effective, 80% effective, or anything like that.
So what do we have to do now? Just wait for people who've had the vaccine to naturally come across COVID in society?
So this is why these clinical trials end up having to recruit so many people. And it's why you have to chase the infections as well. One of the kind of consequences of lockdown being quite effective in the UK was that there suddenly were far fewer people around getting infected. And so it takes that much longer for you to test your vaccine, because the vaccine, you know, you give a placebo to thousands of people and you give your vaccine to thousands more people and you put them out into society and you see after a while who comes back with fewer infections, which of those two groups. And you hope that your vaccinated group is way more protected than your unvaccinated group. But if you don't have many people with the infection around anyway, then obviously, you know, you can be taking data for an awful long time before you see any differences. So that's why the Oxford group have gone to other countries where the epidemic in those countries is really still surging. It gives them more chance to collect the data that actually have to take advantage of that sad situation. But that is really... there is no way around that. You can't do a prediction. You can't do a model and say, yeah, we can look at this this immune response and we know that that will work.
That sounds like it's going to take a very long time.
The Oxford vaccine is one of the most advanced through trials. And Sarah Gilbert, who is the scientist at Oxford, who's sort of heading that project, thinks, you know, we might have that vaccine available under sort of emergency licensing by the end of the year, if all goes well in the countries where they're now sort of testing it. And obviously, you know, by going well, that means it has to not only continue to appear to be really safe, but it has to obviously show that it works pretty well too. So the government's ordered 100 million of doses of that vaccine already. And the idea is to gear up manufacture of those shots before there's even a final word on whether that vaccine works and is a goer. The government's also got orders for 90 million doses of other vaccines which are in development at the moment as well. And those vaccines really are chosen so that they work in different ways. So they're being very sensible in a sense, in that they're spreading their risk. They're making sure that they have shots of vaccine ordered for that have different chances of success.
If one of these jumps all the hurdles and gets to market, is that it? Is that problem solved?
It's not problem solved, because, you know, there are vaccines out there that are like 98% effective. But even with those vaccines, you see infections flaring up. And, you know, I'm thinking of the measles vaccine. The measles vaccine is one of the most effective in the world. But we still get measles flare-ups. The vaccine that we get for COVID-19, you would imagine, probably wouldn't be anywhere near as effective as that. I mean, the flu vaccine is about 65% effective on a good year. The dream would be a vaccine that works really well in everyone, but that, I think, is quite a long shot. I think more realistically, you end up with a vaccine that is partially effective. So then you get into this sort of very sort of interesting kind of question about, okay, how do we use this vaccine? We tend to think of vaccines as something that just stops a disease spreading in a community. And that's great if you've got a really, really good vaccine that literally does just stop you getting infected. But what might happen is you have a vaccine that it just stops you getting really ill. And there's kind of a suggestion that in the animal studies, the monkey studies of the Oxford vaccine, it didn't stop the animals getting infected, but it did stop them getting really ill. Those animals may still have been able to spread the virus. And so you could end up with thinking, okay, what we'll do is we'll give this vaccine to all the older people, all the vulnerable people, so that at least if they get COVID-19, they probably won't end up in hospital or on a ventilator, but it probably won't stop the infection spreading. And then you start having to think about, okay, is another vaccine going to do that? Are we going to be using multiple vaccines at once for the same infection? Or do we then just rely on other types of medicines, if you like, treatments and therapies coming along, which do a different job?
Essentially, what you're saying is that a vaccine could be here by the end of the year and that it might have some positive results, but perhaps not the kind of miracle cure-all we're thinking about. You also mentioned treatment there, the other side of the coin. Is there a way that you can make the immune response more effective once someone is infected?
So there are a number of things people are looking at. One of them is called interferon beta. And there's a company, a spin-out from Southampton University, that produces an inhalable form of this interferon beta. It's a protein that the immune system produces. And it actually, coming back to the orchestra analogy, it actually helps sort of orchestrate the immune response, the immune reaction. And this company released some results suggesting that it could be helping to reduce the sort of severity of disease that people experience. But it was also done on a very small number of people. So it's promising, but it's early doors for interferon beta.
Are there any other options in terms of building immunity?
Yeah, so and one of them dates back to before the 1918 flu pandemic, which is you get blood plasma from recovered patients, and preferably you get blood plasma from the patients who were sickest. And that plasma, if you get it early enough, is actually pretty rich in antibodies because it's helped that person survive the infection. You can actually transfuse that into new patients, and the idea being that those antibodies then help basically boost the person's own immune system and fight off the infection. There are trials going on in many countries that are showing that that is a promising approach. There's a second option where you actually take this idea and kind of turbocharge it. So get a bunch of people who have recovered from coronavirus, again, preferably after a pretty bad infection. You sift through all of their antibodies and you test which ones are most potent. You say, okay, which of the antibodies in this mix are best at taking out coronavirus? You then, which is really neat, is you then just mass produce those antibodies in a manufacturing facility. And this is already done for other conditions. So you just use vats and fermenters and you make antibody. And then you can actually mix together cocktails of kind of lab-grown antibodies and transfuse those into people through a drip when people turn up at a hospital, when people get ill. So that, again, is a way of just really boosting someone's normal immune response.
Very Frankenstein-like.
Yeah.
Ian, I'm not sure that as science editor you realised that you would be taking us all through emotional roller coasters in the way that you just have with me. I've had moments of depression, moments of hope, moments of excitement. And I feel like at the end of this, I'm not quite as sad as I was at the beginning, but I'm not quite in the happy place I wanted to get to. It sounds as if there is some hope around vaccines and therapies, but realistically, they aren't going to be a silver bullet that will give us that ultimate goal of herd immunity, which kind of leads us to a conclusion then, I guess, of this, that we should be preparing ourselves to live with COVID-19. And if that's right, what does that look like for society?
I think this is probably the most interesting question around right now, outside of the immediate sort of, you know, scientific questions. I spoke to a scientist the other day who told me the handshake is gone forever. And okay, it's a small thing.
No.
But you think,
really?
Okay, does that then mean hugs are gone forever? Does that mean, you know, the sort of media lovey kiss on the cheek is gone forever? And I don't know. I really don't know. But I think, you know, I'm an optimist, it appears. And I think all of these things we've been talking about, and some things we haven't been talking about, the vaccines, your immunity once you've had the virus, but also treatments. We've already seen things like dexamethasone, remdesivir look as if they make some difference and help some patients. And I think all of these will chip away at the virus from different angles and get it into a place which is at least better than where we were in February and March. How much we return to normal, I think, is really interesting. I mean, it may well be that we become a nation of face mask wearers, which seems odd to us, but I don't know if it'll seem odd in 6 months' time. And I think there's just going to be all these strange ways that we change behaviorally. There are parallels with HIV to some extent, is that there are some viruses that are around for decades that you adapt around and you do your best with medically. And I think we will probably actually adapt better than we might think, because I think we are actually incredibly adaptable people.
Ian Sample, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks very much.
That's it for today. Thanks to Ian Sample, The Guardian's science editor in London. You can read more of his reporting at theguardian.com. If you liked this episode, you can subscribe and get more by searching for Today in Focus wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Joshua Kelly and Nicholas Cox, the executive producers of Today in Focus, Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Okay, catch you tomorrow.